again to our program, Reasons to Believe, Catholic Apologetics, or Fundamental Theology. My guest, as usual, is Ron Eldred, who teaches history, American history, church history, and world history at John Paul II Catholic High, and also religion. I'm your guest, or I'm your host for our guest, Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus of St. Patrick Catholic Church in 19th and Poplar, on the east end of terrific Terre Haute. Ron, welcome once again. We've been trying to talk about how reason can lay a foundation for us, can be stair steps up to the doorway of faith. We talked about, and this is our 24th session, I believe, we talked about how reason alone has in the past and in history been able to demonstrate the existence of a superior being or God or creator of the universe. We talked about how Jesus claimed to be the Messiah and how he fulfilled all the prophecies in doing that. Just from trying to reason it out, not having to say, well, we're proving it from the Bible. And then, of course, today we're going to talk about, did Jesus actually claim he was God as the Messiah? Because the Jewish people weren't expecting God to come as the Messiah. And also, how did he demonstrate what he was claiming to be God? So, welcome once again. Is it reasonable, Ron, we can start off with, to believe that Jesus, first of all, claimed to be God?
Let me preface that with just a comment. You were talking about how we've been trying to use reason, looking at God's creation and reasoning from that to God's existence and a number of his attributes, his perfections and qualities and things we owe him. And we can know a lot about God without revelation. But once we got through that, then we also went through, though, trying to prove that God did reveal himself.
Okay.
So we spent at least a couple of, that's just one thing you left out.
Yeah, left that out.
In there.
Good.
And so that brings us to the point we're at now. Is it reasonable to believe that Jesus Christ claimed to be God? And yes, there are many places in the New Testament where Jesus does that, and we're going to share some of these with our listeners. For example, when he was found after having been lost in the temple, he said, quote, "How is it that you sought me? Did you not know that I must be in my Father's house?" We find this in Luke 2:45-52, this story.
He's saying this to Mary and Joseph, who came yes. back into Jerusalem to find him.
This is finding in the temple, mysteries of the rosary.
But you could argue about that, but in other words, he didn't say he was God, but he said, I'm in my Father's house.
Yes, in
so
my Father's
house. We're going to give several texts here that compiled together
yes.
certainly point very clearly, some yet to come, that he even said he was God. That's an adumbration, I
yes.
suppose. Okay?
Another instance, when he was in the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, quote, "Who do men say that the Son of Man is?" And they said, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets." He said to them, "Well, what do you say that I am? But who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter replied, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah," which means Bar-Jonah, son of Jonah or son of John, "for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." We find this story in Matthew 16:13-20.
Okay, and if you really wanted to be argumentative, you could still say, well, he's the Son of the living God, but he's not God. So we're going to...
We're getting closer.
Getting closer to a very clear text.
This is where Jesus is gradually unfolding. He even gradually unfolded himself to his apostles because the Jewish people didn't expect that the Messiah, the Christos, the anointed one, was going to be God. And that's one of the reasons, one of the four or five reasons, but maybe the main reasons, is that the Jewish people rejected him.
Such a staggering statement.
Yes.
And it's the very reason that he was killed.
At his baptism by John the Baptist at the River Jordan, quote, "Now when all the people were baptized, and when Jesus also had been baptized and was praying, the heaven was open, and the Holy Spirit descended upon him in bodily form as a dove, and a voice came down from heaven, Thou art my beloved Son, and with thee I am well pleased." End of quote. This is in Luke 3, 21, 22. Obviously, this is getting pretty direct now.
Sure.
This is the Father himself making known or making manifest that Jesus is his Son.
Okay.
Actually, this is the Trinity, a manifestation of the Trinity, where you have the Father speaking, you have the Holy Spirit coming in the form of a dove, and of course, Christ the Son incarnate, the second person. So you have all three persons.
And of course, a person may say, well, you're proving this from the Bible, not from reason. But what we're doing is we had a whole section on how we tried to show that the Bible can be accepted as very accurate history.
Yes.
And this is what the history book of the Bible tells us the people were hearing at the time.
Another example would be at the Transfiguration. This is when Christ let his divinity shine through his humanity. And when God the Father said, quote, "This is my beloved Son with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." When the disciples heard this, they fell on their faces and were filled with awe. We find this in Matthew 17:1-8. Another, during the Feast of the Tabernacles.
Now we're getting really clear.
Yes. That Jesus began to speak more openly, even says it in the Bible, more openly and forcefully about whom he was. He began to refer to himself as the living water. We find this in John 7:37-38. The light of the world, John 8:12. And claiming he was greater than their father Abraham. After a particularly intense debate with the scribes and Pharisees in the temple, Jesus said to them, quote, "Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am." So they took up stones to throw at him. But Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple. We find that story in John 58:59. In other words, the Jews, that is those Jews who were his enemies, knew perfectly well that Jesus was claiming to be God when he referred to himself as I am.
And the I am was?
It was the name that how God identified himself to Moses in the burning bush. We find this story in Genesis 3.
And then, of course, it says they took up stones to kill him because he was blaspheming.
Which, of course, was a punishment for blasphemy.
Claiming something only God could claim.
Yes.
Okay.
And then another case would be once in the temple, after the scribes and Pharisees had brought to Jesus a woman who had been caught in adultery. A conversation developed between him and them, and Jesus said, quote, "I bear witness to myself, and the Father who sent me bears witness to me. They said to him, therefore, where is your Father? Jesus answered, you know neither me nor my Father. If you knew me, you would know my Father also. These words he spoke in the treasury as he taught in the temple. But no one arrested him because his hour had not yet come. Then when the conversation turned to Abraham, Jesus said, quote, your father Abraham rejoiced that he was to see me to see my day. And he saw it and was glad. The Jews then said to him, you are not yet 50 years old, and have you seen Abraham? Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am. So they took up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple. This is found in John 8. Again, the Jews knew that Jesus was claiming to be God, and they sought to kill him.
Okay, for blasphemy.
For blasphemy. Another instance would be during the Feast of the Dedication at Jerusalem, when Jesus was walking in the temple in the portico of Solomon. And the Jews gathered around him and said, quote, how long will you keep us in suspense? If you are the Christ, tell us plainly. Jesus answered them, I told you, and you do not believe. The works that I do in my Father's name, they bear witness to me, but you do not believe, because you do not belong to my sheep. My sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me. And I give them eternal life, and they shall never perish, and no one shall snatch them out of my hand. My Father, who has given them to me, is greater than all, and no one is able to snatch them out of the Father's hands. I and the Father are one. In other words, again, the Jews took up stones to stone him to death.
Again, for blasphemy. I and the Father are one is pretty strong statement.
Yes, it's even getting more precise. As I said, Jesus gradually unfolded his divinity, even to his most intimate followers, the apostles. When Jesus delivered his farewell address to his apostles at the Last Supper, he told them that he was the way, the truth, and the life, and he and the Father were one. That if one sees him, they also see the Father. That he is in the Father, and the Father is in him.
I think Philip asked him, Lord, you keep talking about the Father. Show us the Father, and we'll be satisfied. And Jesus said to Philip, he who sees me sees the Father. And you know, Pope Benedict keeps referring in many of his talks that Jesus is God with a face. And what a powerful and a beautiful way to describe Jesus as he describes himself.
Well, we find this story in John 14, and Jesus was very clearly telling them, you know, his apostles, that he's God. Obviously, he's preparing them, of course, for what was to happen later that night and the next few days. And because their faith was really, even with what they had seen and heard, their faith was still shaken to the ground.
Oh, my. So this is at the Last Supper, the night before he dies and is captured in the Garden of Gethsemane and taken to before Caiaphas and the Supreme Court.
Then after his arrest, Jesus was questioned by the at the palace by the high priest, Lord Joseph Caiaphas. And there he was falsely accused and mistreated by the Jews. We find this in Matthew 26. We find this in Mark 14. We find this story in Luke 22. The chief priest and the whole council tried to get false testimony against Jesus so that they could put him to death. But they could find none. And although many false witnesses had come, you know, to forward, eventually two came forward and said, this fellow said, I am to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days. In response, the high priest stood up and said, have you no answer to make? I'm quoting now. What is it that these men testify against you? But Jesus remained silent. And the high priest said to him, quote, I adjure you, by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. Jesus said to him, you have said so. But I tell you, hereafter, you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven. End of quote. Then the high priest tore his robes and said, quote, he has uttered blasphemy. Why do we still need witnesses? You have now heard his blasphemy, Matthew 26, 62-65 verses. So in the early morning hours, Jesus was taken to the temple area where he was tried, convicted, and sentenced to death for blasphemy by the Sanhedrin, the official Jewish court of law.
Okay, so you've been giving some good texts, Ron, to help us see that if we just accept the Bible as good history, Jesus was claiming not just to be the Messiah, the long-awaited promised one, the deliverer, the anointed one, but he was actually claiming to be God, which was staggering not only to the Jewish people, but even to the apostles.
Yeah, because Messiah doesn't necessarily mean that the Messiah was to be God. In fact, the Jewish people, for the most part, didn't believe this. They believed he was just going to be a special man with a special mission sent by God to organize them and lead them and help them overthrow their enemies. And their enemies at that time, of course, happened to be the Roman Empire or anybody else that would be their enemies. But there also was a strain of Messianism, which was, for the most part, largely ignored by the Jewish people. And this is the suffering servant that we find, of course, in Isaiah and in several other places, but especially in Isaiah. In fact, a class I teach at John Paul in World History Today, we just happen to be talking about that subject today.
And the suffering servant of Isaiah was the one that is so described when Jesus goes through his the way of the cross and the crowning with thorns and the sorrowful mysteries of the rosary.
Yes, it gets it in fairly precise. You might recall the story of when after Jesus arose from the dead. By tradition, he first appeared to his mother, and then he appeared to Mary Magdalene and the women at the empty tomb. And then, as best I can figure out, he appeared to the disciples on the road to Emmaus. And then, of course, after that, to Peter, and then to the apostles in the upper room. Well, as this was Sunday morning, let's say, and these two disciples, they weren't apostles, two of his disciples were walking to Emmaus, which was about 20 miles away, northwest of Jerusalem. And they were all down in the dumps. They were sorrowful, and Jesus, walks along with them, comes along and walks along with them, and they didn't recognize him, probably because he had his glorified body, and he didn't want them to recognize him at the time. So he asked them, what's wrong? Why are you guys so down? And he said, well, guys, where you been, buddy? Something like that, he must have said, where you been this weekend, and what's been going on here?
Are you the only ones in Jerusalem?
Right, the only one that
you
doesn't
don't know
about
this.
And so Jesus proceeds to tell them as they walk along this 20 miles or so, he proceeds to tell them in the Old Testament where the Messiah was prophesied. And he heavily emphasizes this suffering servant idea, that this is what the Messiah was to be, a suffering servant. But that was one of the reasons, though, one of four or five reasons that the Jews rejected Jesus. Partly they rejected him because they didn't think he was going to be God, and so that's where the blasphemy comes in. And the other is because they couldn't see the Messiah being someone who wasn't riding a big muscular white horse like a Roman general, a conqueror, but someone who rides a little puny donkey, on a Palm Sunday, have humility and what have you, who was to suffer an ignominious death, the scourging and the crucifixion. The Jews considered crucifixion to be a curse. It was just something, it was for a criminal, it was a criminal's death. In fact, that's the kind of death they wanted Jesus to have. They hated him that much that they wanted him to be cursed. And they wanted his death to be ignominious. Not only painful, but just because that's the way that criminals were killed.
Sure. And it was the most cruel form of punishment that the Romans ever devised.
Well, certainly. In fact, that's the word, the crucifixion cross, I think, if I recall originally, comes from that idea of we have excruciating as a word, meaning painful, mm-hmm. but it was an ignominious death.
Okay, so the suffering servant, Isaiah, maybe was around the year 700 B.C. or 800?
Yes. Yeah, Isaiah was the prophet to the northern kingdom. I'm sorry, to the southern kingdom. He did go to the northern kingdom, that's true, the kingdom of Israel, but mostly he went to the southern kingdom, the kingdom of Judah. The 10 tribes broke off, the 10 northern tribes broke off after Solomon died for various reasons, his son Rehoboam. They broke off from him, rebelled against him, and broke off and set up their own country there in Samaria and made that the headquarters. And Elijah was the prophet to the northern kingdom, and of course his successor, Elisha. But in the southern kingdom, it was Isaiah was one of the main prophets, and then later on Jeremiah. Although Isaiah did go to the northern kingdom for a while too. But both of these kingdoms were destroyed. We don't have time, of course, to go into the details of that.
Well, let's take another step in this. We've tried to establish from the scripture as history that Jesus claimed to be and fulfilled the prophecies of the Messiah. Now, we just tried to show that he very clearly claimed to be God. The next step would be, did he do anything to prove that he was God?
I think Jesus proved beyond any reasonable doubt that he is God by doing things that only God can do.
All right, such as?
Well, by displaying every attribute of deity, including omniscience, that is knowing everything, omnipresence. He could be anywhere if he wanted to be. Omnipotence, he could perform great miracles and even bring the dead to life. So I guess omnipotence is all that you could call that. Immutability and some of the other attributes that only God has.
Okay. All right, let's go on a little bit and get a little more detailed.
Well, his teaching was unrivaled. And he had really just a divine understanding of people, more than just a good psychological understanding, a much deeper, something much, much more deeper, much more profound than that.
I heard him call recently the most profound and learned psychiatrist the world has ever known.
Certainly.
His understanding of human nature.
Well, the most important, he led a life of perfect virtue and holiness. Only God can do that. Only God can, because he is holy. You know, God is holy.
In fact, he went so far, didn't he, to say, who will convict me of sin?
Yes. And by making prophecies that come true, that came true, such as the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem and of his suffering, death, and resurrection. Now, only God knows the future, of course.
Okay.
And performing many miracles, such as healing the sick, restoring sight to the blind and hearing to the deaf, driving out demons, curing the crippled, multiplying the loaves and fishes, walking on water, calming the sea, and raising the dead to life. And of course, only God can change the laws of nature. Okay. And then finally, his greatest miracle of all was his resurrection under his own power.
Okay, so we would really claim that that was the crowning of his miracles. In fact, Paul went so far as to say, if Jesus is not risen from the dead, our preaching is in vain and your faith is in vain. Okay, well, let's talk a minute about, we said Jesus worked many, many miracles. What exactly is a miracle? And then why did Jesus perform them?
Start out with, if miracles exist, then God exists.
Because?
It's a setting aside of the natural, of the way things
something
are.
Happening that nothing else could explain.
Nothing else
except
could explain.
An intervention of God.
Right.
Okay.
For an event to be classified as a miracle, it must be extraordinary. That is, not an occurrence in the ordinary course of events. Moreover, the context in which a miracle occurs must be religious. It cannot have a natural explanation. Otherwise, extraordinary events that are not in a religious context or can be explained by natural occurrences are what we would call oddities or curiosities or strange happenings, as is found in Ripley's Believe It or Not. The logic of a miraculous event in a syllogism is as follows. Now, we never explain what a syllogism is, but I think everybody should be able to follow through this simple little syllogism.
It's a way of reasoning.
It's a way of reasoning, yes. In fact, I found out yesterday there's over 256 different types of syllogism that the medieval scholastics used.
I'm glad we didn't go into detail.
Yes. But you have what's called a major premise. And the major premise is a miracle, this is a statement now, a miracle is an event whose only adequate explanation is the extraordinary and direct intervention of God. This is, again, the major premise, which is a general statement. And then we have what's called a minor premise. There are numerous well-attested miracles. This is the minor premise, which is a particular application of the general statement we just made. And then the conclusion is, therefore, there are numerous events, whose only adequate explanation is the extraordinary and direct intervention of God. So then we conclude that God exists.
If we had a blackboard, it'd be easier to
follow
that.
Yes. And that's why we stayed away from using this type of thing very much. We use the more experiential, that is, a human experience way of proving God's existence and things of that sort, which is the way the church is using now anyway, more than these rational proofs.
But all through history, the syllogism was a very fine way of trying to reason to more enlightened information and truth.
Well, it served the church well.
Sure. Well, so in other words, the point is that a miracle is something that can only be explained. There's no other explanation except by God's intervention. Okay, well, the Bible has many miracles. Can you comment on any of these?
Well, many miracles are reported in the Old Testament that occurred among the chosen people, the Hebrews. For example, God speaking to Moses in the burning bush. We find this in Exodus 2:23. Well, to take too long to go into where these were found, but the 10 plagues that God inflicted on the Egyptians because of Pharaoh's hardened heart. The parting of the Red Sea during the Exodus to save the Israelites from the Egyptian army. The pillar of fire by night and smoke by day to guide the Israelites would be another miracle. The feeding of the Israelites manna and quail. The watering of the Israelites by Moses striking his rod on rocks at various times. The walls of Jericho tumbling down as the Israelites marched around it. Lighting of the wood and Elijah's triumph over the priest of Baal. In fact, we talked about that in another one of my classes today. That particular event and many others.
Sure.
And Jesus himself performed many miracles out of love and compassion for his fellow man, and so that the disciples might believe in him. So he had both motives, so that people would believe in him, and then secondly, of course, certainly out of compassion, out of love. I mean, if anybody had the kind of power he had, and you would certainly want to use it.
In fact, he could hardly keep from using it at times.
Yes.
Because people so petitioned him with such pleading voices, like the Canaanite woman, Lord, even the house pets get the crumbs that fall from the table, mm-hmm. So you can certainly take care of my daughter, even though we're not among the chosen people in the household of the faith.
Well, the apostles, they perform many miracles, as reported in the Acts of the Apostles. And the early church fathers performed numerous miracles so that unbelievers might believe. Moreover, countless miracles have been recorded during the Middle Ages, and all these miracles occurred within a religious context and could not have had any kind of a natural explanation.
And one of the favorite pastimes for a while was to say that you can give a human explanation to any miracle that's reported in the Bible. And there was one recently that was really way out. Some professor talked about Jesus walking on the water.
Oh, my goodness.
When the Bible talked about him walking on the water, he was really walking along the seashore.
Yeah.
with the waves.
I don't know how this is possible. The boat's out in the middle of a lake that's 12 miles long and 6 miles across. But
is that what it is, 12 and 6? But I mean, that was a very popular pastime for debunking all the miracles and just saying, well, they just weren't true.
Well, as you mentioned in one of our earlier sessions, Rudolf Bultmann and his demythologizing of the Bible and what kind of motives they had for doing that.
Sure. All right, well, our time is coming to a close again, Ron. We'll take up with modern miracles in our next round. Thanks for your wonderful explanations there. And to our listeners, thanks for being with us. May God bless you always and in all ways.